start spreading the news. I'm leaving today. I want to be a part of it. New York, New York. These vagabond shoes are longing to stray right through the very heart of it. New York, New York. I want to wake up in a city that doesn't sleep and find I'm king of the hill, top of the heap. These little town blues are melting away. I'll make a brand new start of it in old New York. If I can make it there, I'll make it anywhere. It's up to you, New York.
Well, that's Frank Sinatra singing New York, New York. Introduced us here to another episode of Conservative Casual Friday, a weekly blog talk radio show with your show host, Andrew Herrick, where we like to discuss important issues of the day for conservatives and others. And today we want to go to the Big Apple, as it were, in particular to the Metropolitan Museum of Art, where we want to discuss a new book, Pilgrimage to the Museum, Man's Search for God Through Art and Time, by veteran Wall Street investor and Catholic evangelist Stephen Auth. A new book out, very insightful book, out from Sophia Institute Press, looking at various works of art in the Metropolitan Museum of Art through the eyes of spirituality and Christian faith. Well, Stephen, thanks for joining the show.
Thanks for having me, Andrew.
Well, just starting out, how did you get interested in art, and have you always been a religious, or, you know, what's the interaction here between faith and art in your life?
I think I've always been interested in beauty, like most of us are, Andrew, and certainly while at an undergraduate at college, a liberal arts school like Princeton, you get all sorts of opportunities to study just about everything, and major in history and economics and ended up going into business school. I had just attraction to the beauty of art and ended up taking most of the art history classes and that on offer there. And a lifelong of learning more about art, my investment business took me all over the world for the next 40 years, and every time, even to this day, when I get to a big city, the first thing I do is, you know, grab some time to get to the art museum and, you know, learn a little bit more. Over the years, kind of kept compounding on itself, and my wife and I began many years ago giving tours of the Met to our visitors to New York. They always wanted to go to the museum, and we sort of know our way around the museum. And about years ago, I really started to come back to my Catholic faith of my childhood. I'm probably still nominally Catholic even then, but really start to see the world through the eyes of God and had a reconversion experience. And after that, the art started to look different to me. Kind of the light dawned on me that, I mean, this seems obvious to some of your listeners, but it really is about the search for beauty, which, of course, is God. And I think he kind of leaves the impression of his, what our soul is. And when you start presumption, now wait a second here, all art is in some ways a search for our creator, even when we ourselves don't realize that's what we're doing. And you start reapproaching the art that way, it kind of explodes your mind in terms of understanding more about what's really happening in these paintings. And so as my wife and I reapproached the art and the tour that we were giving at the Met at level, it just started to click in a way that we realized that all this art is connected, even over 5,000 years. I mean, we start out in ancient Egypt and end up in the modern era. And, yeah, about a third of that art is overtly religious, Christian. A lot is not, but nevertheless, the same themes and motifs that appear in early Egypt, you know, recur again and again. And you see that becomes a kind of gripping journey through time and space and spirituality. And people have been encouraging us over the years who've been on the tour to convert it into a book format. In fact, is even richer than the tour itself, and has the advantage of bringing you, you know, maybe bringing this idea to a bigger audience. So that was the inception of the pilgrimage to the museum.
Yeah, it's very interesting. You do indeed start out in the book with ancient Egypt. I mean, you talk about at the Metropolitan Museum of Art, they have this structure, I believe, that's been elements have been taken from Egypt and sort of reconstituted in the museum, this mastaba tomb for upper class people in Egypt, you know, similar to the idea of the pyramids for the pharaohs, that this sort of like house-like structure that people would be put in for the afterlife. And the thinking then in ancient Egypt you describe is that you would have, as it were, a U-Haul following a hearse. And that, so you take in all these things for the afterlife, and you get mummified. You talk about this burial chambers for a person named Pernib, this tomb of Pernib. And so this idea then is that the Egyptians sort of thought of themselves as becoming gods. Is that a common idea throughout religion before the Bible, that people sort of thought of themselves as trying to become gods? Is that, therefore, is the revelation to the Hebrews, as you discuss in the book, that this is pre-revelation times in ancient Egypt, is that really significant in the Bible, that it, you know, tells us that, you know, we're not gods, we're creators, we're creations of God?
Yeah, I think, you know, it's easy enough to kind of almost snicker at the Egyptians for making the obvious mistake that they're not God and making themselves God in a way. And you can see it in the art, how they picture themselves as larger than life, with the little people, if you will, serving them while they put themselves in a position of God. And you can look at that and say, gee, it's a mistake. But when you reflect on it, isn't it that find ourselves making ourselves gods, or making ourselves God? You know, it's the sin of pride, right? And when we do that, we almost always lose him, at least for some period of time. So it's one of the things that come out of the tour, this idea that one of the ways not to find God, if you will, is to try to make yourself God. And, you know, there's other points in time and space that we get to where people do the exact opposite and they seem to find him. So, you know, it's one of the messages maybe in the book that, you know, we sometimes can lose track of the very thing we're seeking, which is beauty, which is God, when we start to think of ourselves as that creator instead of the creator.
Yeah, right. So, yeah, you're really losing sight of what's eternal, what's immortal, in sort of a vain quest to puff yourself up. I mean, another lesson you draw from ancient Egypt is this a sculpture of an Egyptian pharaoh, a ruler, Hatshepsut, if I'm pronouncing that correct, in the New Kingdom of ancient Egypt. The ancient Egypt is divided up into, as you say, right, is the three kingdoms of Old, Middle, and New Kingdoms. And she apparently came from the New Kingdom. But then the son, I believe, another ruler came, Thutmose III, and wanted to blot out the memory of this queen, Hatshepsut, and all of her statues and so forth were destroyed. And then this statue that the archaeologists found thousands of years later was then eventually brought to the Met in New York. You know, you talk about this idea that, you know, with all of her accomplishments, her power, you know, she fell. I mean, do you find that when you look at art, does this often bring your attention to your own mortality or to people's mortality?
Well, yeah, I mean, it brings your attention to God, but also to you know, the passage to Him through a death experience. What I found beautiful about the Hatshepsut statue, well, first of all, she's kind of interesting just because she was a strong female pharaoh. She wasn't the only one, but maybe the most famous and probably one of the best rulers of ancient Egypt. But you know, she has this statue of her is very unusual in that it's white for one thing. It's a beautiful white limestone that it's carved out of. But more importantly, it's just really lifelike, and which is a little un-Egyptian and extremely beautiful. But of course, you know, things don't go well for her. She builds this temple to herself and to the goddess Sun, but she sort of installs herself alongside him as a god, and it doesn't take long after her death before her jealous stepson, who she'd kind of been ruling in his stead for 20 years, you know, just destroys all her statues. What's kind of interesting about that statue is that when it was brought back to the Met, we only had parts of it. And Berlin had other parts, and we had other parts of a similar statue in Berlin, and London had parts. And so the different museums of the world eventually figured out that they had parts of each other's statues, and they kind of traded them back and forth to put her back together again. And she's sitting there today at the Met as a really, you know, radiant beauty, perhaps not a god, though.
Mm-hmm. Oh, interesting. Yeah, sort of collecting all the pieces, the Legos and so forth. I guess it shows you what modern scholarship can do to sort of restore something that was destroyed in the ancient world. And this queen and Hatshepsut can, I guess now, thanks to that, sort of live on again or have her memory restored. Well, you know, then you turn in the book from the ancient Egyptians to the Greeks to the ancient world, and you know, you talk about how the Greeks they wanted to they had this idea that they would instead of contrast to the Egyptians that they were trying to sort of make themselves make men into gods, the Greeks would make their gods into men, and they believed that you know, the best of human beings were in fact gods. Like at the Olympics, they would celebrate the beauty of the athletes' bodies and compete nude, and they had this idea then that you know, God can be discovered through logic and reason. You know, after all, because God is among human beings. What is the relationship there between faith and reason, I guess? Did other religions before the Greeks or along with the Greeks had this idea of a rational God? And how did that relate then to the Bible later on?
Well, the Greeks certainly had a huge influence on the Christians and vice versa. And what's interesting is St. Paul, a lot of your Christian viewers will know that he famously arrived in Athens one day and was convinced, based on what he knew about, he himself was Greek culturally, Jewish, obviously Jewish Greek, but spoke Greek. And he thought this would be a cinch because the Greeks talk about this perfect beauty that must be God. And if you look at all their art, what's unique about it and different about it relative to Roman sculptures is everything is perfect. They kind of view because they're creating art that describes God, a God, be perfect. And so a lot of, virtually all of their statuary is idealized forms. They're not really portraits. They're idealized forms of the perfect man or the perfect woman. Goddess Aphrodite appears in the Pilgrimage to the Museum, and, you know, just a beautiful image of a woman, a perfect one. And the man, although I, you know, present company accepted, Andrew, I'm sure you're in great shape, but nothing like, you know, the hippopotamus, you know, in spear bearer in ancient Egypt by Pericles. So you've got, you know, these wonderful, or Polycletus, I should say. But so Paul thought that it would be easy to convert the Greeks. All he had to do is explain to them, hey, look, this is the God you're looking for. You know, he's here. He's Christ. He is the perfect man being. But of course, they rejected him because it required a leap of faith that he had risen from the dead, and the Greeks just couldn't get there through logic. And, you know, we need to use our heads when we're seeking God, but to a certain extent, art and beauty, don't they kind of, they're kind of bigger than that, and the Greeks couldn't quite get off of that, and so sadly, St. Paul really converted almost nobody in ancient Athens, just a handful of folks initially, at least according to the New Testament, were converted in that trip he made.
Oh, interesting. So in history, it's often considered that this idea of a resurrection of Jesus was a real stumbling block. Why was that? Because they just couldn't accept the idea that a God would be killed?
Yeah, killed seemed inappropriate to them, and certainly coming back from the dead seemed completely nuts. So,
mm-hmm.
you know, it was a leap of faith that the Athenians were not willing to make.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Well, you know, then you turn to the Romans and you talk about art there. That in the Roman art, you see that everything sort of focused on the here and now, and that gods in the Roman culture, they just sort of were sort of these gods that had to be placated. They could fight among themselves or intervene in human life, and so Romans just sort of were concerned about keeping them at ease, and so that they could have a nice life. Was Roman religion then really sort of self-serving, and did Romans have any sort of thought of the afterlife?
Yeah, I kind of look at Rome and look at their art as relatively godless. And, you know, technically they had gods, et cetera. A lot of them inherited gods from other cultures, including the Greek cultures. But in effect, from their perspective, the only god at all was really the emperor. And he wasn't really a god, but simply, you know, the big honcho on earth. And so the Romans had this sort of godless society, which, of course, is full of violence and profanity and, you know, a lot of issues and problems, as we know, historically. And what's interesting about their art, there's a wonderful image in the Met and in the Pilgrimage of one of the Roman emperors, Trebonius Gallus, who, you know, got to be emperor by basically betraying his boss, the previous emperor, also a general. And just two or three years after making himself the emperor, there was a coup, and he ended up being murdered along with his son by his own troops. So it was a short-lived career, if you will. And there's this image that I use to try to help people understand the difference between Roman and Greek sculptures. I mean, the Greeks had this idea of God as the perfect being. In the case of the Romans, there is no god. And you have Trebonius Gallus, who's now the god, I suppose, because he's the emperor. And there's image in his face with his creased brow and concern and worries. And you say, gee, here's a guy who's supposed to be on top of the world, and he looks like a pretty nervous individual. And right next to him, in the pilgrimage and actually in the museum, we show an image of a God-fearing emperor, pretty well-known probably even to your viewers or to your listeners, Constantine, right, who was the first Christian emperor of the empire and made the Roman Empire into a Christian empire. Well, Constantine is looking up, and he's got bigger problems than Trebonius Gallus, frankly, at his stage of his rule. The barbarians were literally at the gate by then. But he's looking up confidently to the heavens, presumably to God, with a look of calm and serenity on his face. I do a reflection on this, called that, you know, the faces that we wear. And, you know, I always check myself on the way out the door in the morning. Do I have that Trebonius Gallus face where I'm kind of denying God and thinking it's all in my hands? It's, you know, it's me or the highway. Or I'm placing myself, you know, in the hands of God and letting him sort of drive things a little bit. And that's the look of calm that you get from the face of Constantine. So I think all of us, like many of the images we see in the pilgrimage, we all have these different aspects of it, you know, and we're all prone to these maybe mistakes. But certainly the Romans as a culture were very godless. There's obviously a kind of reference in the discussion about what went on in Rome to the current day, right, where we're in a kind of godless culture now. And there's a lot of people that walk around the streets looking pretty angry.
Well, yeah, you talk about Constantine and the development of the Roman Empire, the Christianization of the society, even though, as you know in the book, the Christians had to go through waves of persecution before Constantine declared Christianity the official religion of the empire and had his conversion. And you say that, you know, Constantine, according to what we know, seemed to became a devout Christian. What does that say about with these Christians being persecuted by Diocletian and others, and yet still their faith perseveres, it wins conference, and you talk about that conquering hearts and minds with a new message of a loving God, loving all of his children as human beings, and sent his son to die with us on the cross, and that this love ultimately conquered the empire. I mean, what does this say about sort of human desire then and now, and the Christian message? I mean, does love conquer hate in the end?
That's my conclusion. I mean, if you look at 5,000 years, it always ends up that love conquers hate. I know sometimes it can seem pretty dark, and the world right now seems pretty hate-filled, but my takeaway from all this is fairly confident that sooner or later, love will conquer hate. I see it on the streets of New York, you know, my earlier book that you may have read called The Missionary of Wall Street, where we're out, you know, talking. We've talked now to, I think, close to 3 million people on the streets. But what we find, even in that kind of a culture where, yeah, things are a little bit difficult, let's put it that way, approaching people with a little bit of Christian love and joy in your heart can really change the conversation pretty quickly, actually.
Mm-hmm. And finally, you then move into the Middle Ages, and just as sort of a comment and overview of that time, you know, you talk about like how the in a spiritual context, the Middle Ages were not really dark at all, as they're often referred to as the Dark Ages, but they could really be called the Light Ages. I mean, do we in the modern era have a false understanding of the Middle Ages?
Well, I think, you know, generally people have come to believe, understand that there was a lot more going on in the so-called Dark Ages than we earlier gave them credit for. But really my reference there is that if you think about it from a spiritual perspective and the art of the Middle Ages, to me, there was something about the art that really understood that, you know, you are God and I am not, you know, and that it's a kind of contrast, if you will, to the tomb of Pernib that we discussed earlier, where Pernib puts himself in the position of God. He paints himself bigger than life. He's got all the little people serving him. in the artwork of the Middle Ages, it's quite the opposite. God, Christ, God the Father, they're always shown as the big people, if you will. And the other thing about the Middle Ages that people don't fully understand, if you look at their art, is a lot of their art is two-dimensional and somewhat abstract, and people think, well, they're kind of simpletons, they didn't know how to paint better. But from their perspective, they're painting a being and or spiritual beings that are in another world, that are in a spiritual realm, that are somewhere up in the heavens. And so during the Middle Ages, the artwork is kind of abstract and spiritual, in some ways similar to the Egyptians in that sense, but with the idea that God is up in heaven and we're here looking up to him. And there's some beautiful artwork in pilgrimage that we go through where this theme of, you know, you are God, I am not, comes through, and in a very beautiful way, I think. And some of the really interesting things to meditate on to kind of get yourself in that framework.
Yeah, one thing I found an interesting comment, you talked about, you know, I mean, speaking of the Middle Ages and building of great cathedrals and so forth, you talked about that in the Catholic Church specifically, you know, in the Mass, Christ comes physically in the sacrament of transubstantiation and that miracle. And so therefore, you know, churches, cathedrals are built with these magnificent flying buttresses and designs so that you can have thin walls with, you know, high glass windows that with light comes in and that you write that this is the closest we get to heaven on earth, you know, and so therefore for many Catholics around the world watching Notre Dame in Paris, France, go up in flames about, you know, 2 years ago, you know, was like watching heaven burn. Can really, I guess that prompts a question, you know, does beautiful art sort of demand, having truly beautiful art demand that you have a vision of a loving God, the ultimate eternal beauty?
I don't know that you need, you know, I don't know that you need to be a believer to create images of beauty in art. I think that God has put the image of himself in all of us, in our souls. I think that artists in particular have a connection to him, to that beauty. And I think some of them find it, but sometimes their orientation misplaces where he is. And things get off course. And a lot of that is driven by the culture. It looks like we're going through chronologically here, so I don't know if I want to jump too far ahead of you, but you know, you kind of you go through this period where you kind of really find God in many ways in art, in the Renaissance in particular, I would say. And you have this battle of light and darkness in the 16 and 1700s where the answer is a little more ambiguous. And then, you know, the arrival of the Enlightenment in the 1800s, 19th century, and, you know, God is dead, you know, per Friedrich Nietzsche, and a contrasting image from that period where basically the culture has killed off God. We've stopped believing him, and the artists kind of go along with that. And then they start to think of themselves as the creator himself, and art becomes about the artist and not about the creator. And you get an image of, I call it God's tomb, which is a real contrast to where we are at the moment in this conversation about these beautiful stained glass windows in the Middle Ages in the churches. And we have one in the pilgrimage to meditate on, but it, you know, fast forward 500 years or so, and you're looking at an image in my mind of God's tomb, Rennes Cathedral by Monet, where he paints the church from the outside in. His objective is to show us his talent at rendering different effects of light on the stonework of the cathedral at different points in the day. Famously paints 34 images of Rennes Cathedral in this series. We've got one at the Metropolitan. But what strikes me about the image at the Met is he's eliminated any sign of humanity from the painting and any sign of God. For instance, all the statuary, the famous facade of Rennes, it's full of images, statues of Christian saints, and they've all been eliminated in the painting. They're kind of blurred out. The doors are closed, and the stained glass windows are viewed from the outside in, which, of course, at that point, they just gray out. And I don't know that he was consciously, I think he's sort of not really consciously, he's not, Monet, by all intents and purposes, was not a believer, but in effect, he kind of was painting an image of a cathedral where God doesn't exist, you know, where God is dead.
That image is indeed stark from Monet. I guess that series on the cathedral, the famed cathedral at Rouen, was painted, I believe, in the 1890s. And the image you show in the book is, you know, it's really kind of pale and kind of stark. Whereas you contrast that where you talk about the glory of the cathedrals in the Middle Ages. You have the stained glass windows. This one you took from a church in Paris depicting the life of St. Vincent of Saragossa, if I believe his martyrdom, and, you know, the colors and so forth and the story and that. So, yeah, it is a dramatic contrast that cathedral presented in Rouen. It's just really kind of looks kind of like a monolith. It's just sort of like a piece of stone. There's no one there. It's just kind of very bland indeed, like a tomb. It's just very dead.
Yeah. And it's interesting you mentioned – well, go ahead. No, go ahead.
Oh, no, go ahead. Yeah. Add on to that, yeah.
Now, I'm just fascinated. There's a reference in the book, but you sort of quoted from some of it. But the, you know, the day that the cathedral burned, that Notre Dame burned, which was really hard for a lot of Catholics to take because for many of us it is sort of next to St. Patrick's Cathedral in Rome and St. Peter's. I mean, it's one of the most famous cathedrals in the world, and it's the first place I would always run to on my way to the Louvre, you know, in Paris. And the night it burned down, of course, all the archaeologists are coming out talking about the flying buttresses and how they're all being hurt by the mortar, and it was all kind of a very scientific explanation, which is one of my dissatisfactions in general with a lot of explanations of art today by the establishment, if you will. And here I find myself that morning on one of the big business networks, literally asked to come on. The anchor knew I was, you know, reasonably devout Catholic. I'm not a saint by any means, but, you know, at least attempting. And brought me on to talk about what happened with Notre Dame. And, you know, to a believer's perspective, this was not so much about it's why we had the flying buttresses, right? I mean, it was, as you said, to hold the beautiful stained glass windows and to watch Notre Dame burning. It was like watching heaven burn for us.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a very dramatic description there. Well, I guess maybe more turning towards a more sort of uplifting side of things. The strength you receive from faith. You talk about Filippino Lippi's Madonna and Child, which I believe comes from the 1400s or so, maybe the 1300s, if I have the date on that again correct. Often called the Blue Madonna. And it shows Mary cradling the Christ child. And, you know, you note in this painting that it seems like a very relaxing, I mean, it shows a scene of Mary and her child enjoying life together as mother and child, even though, as you note in the book, you know, obviously Christ has a serious mission and is going to face the passion of the cross, as indicated in the painting. There's an open pomegranate on a table next to Jesus, which the pomegranate was a symbol of death I guess, from ancient times. Do you often draw sort of relaxation from art? Do what sort of paintings calm you for the times of stress that you might have coming ahead?
Well, I have plenty of stress along with the rest of us, but as a chief investment officer of a big mutual fund company, certainly I have my share of that. That Blue Madonna is a very beautiful painting to meditate on, and it's a happy, idyllic scene, if you will, a little bit idealized perhaps. Created quite a stir at the Met when they cleaned it, you know, because a lot of paintings today that we see in art museums have been veneered over so many times over the centuries. The blues have turned black and the reds have turned, burgundy. And people didn't appreciate that painting, how much, you know, how blue it was until they removed all the veneer. And it just really created quite a scene. There's another painting in that same chapter on the Renaissance that I think is even more calming to meditate on. It's called The Madonna Enthroned, the Madonna and Child Enthroned, and by another great of the Renaissance artists, Raphael. Some think maybe the greatest painter of all time, not in my book necessarily, but certainly a wonderful painter. And what's wonderful about the Renaissance paintings for me is that they're so perfect. They were trying to view reality through the eyes of God, so everything was very idealized, and they used mathematics to create perfect scientific perspective. And the painting is very simple. They eliminate any kind of extra detail. So in the Madonna Enthroned, you're sitting in front of her, and your eye just gets drawn from the start to the very center of the painting, which is Mary holding Jesus. And there's, because the thing is so worked out and so clear and simple, it literally can just completely calm you down if you sit in front of it. And you often see at the Met folks literally just sitting in front of that painting for an hour. You know, just taking it in, if you will, or being pulled into the painting, almost pulled into it is probably the way to think about that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and indeed, Mary comes up in a lot as a theme of many of these paintings. You also discuss this Virgin Annunciate by Anatello de Messina from Sicily, which is sometimes considered the Catholic Mona Lisa, and you say, you know, you describe it as one of the greatest works of art in the history of man's search for God, and you discuss it in the context of this painting that, you know, the sort of the challenges that Mary had of you know, having this annunciation to her from God that, you know, she would be the bearer of the Messiah, of Jesus, and she would have to go through all of these trials. I mean, King Herod would try to slaughter Jesus, and so she would have to run away. And, you know, she'd also have to face the whole issue of scandal of a virgin birth, of giving birth without, having been betrothed to her husband, Joseph. So you go into extensive discussion about Mary's virtues. Does Mary also ever figure much in Protestant art, or is that mainly just in Catholic art that you have such a focus on the role of Mary and sort of this heroic status that she has?
Yeah, that's a really good question, and I don't know that I can name off the top of my head a Mary painting by one of the great Protestant, that wouldn't have been more from the Reformation period. I mean, from the Renaissance period, which ended in the 1520s, Luther only came on the scene in 1517, so there was really no Renaissance art would be called Protestant, but certainly in the Baroque period, you don't see, for different reasons, Mary, but that could be one of them, that, from a Protestant perspective, they appreciate Mary as Mother of God, but they kind of downplay her role. And, you know, there's almost a misunderstanding, frankly, amongst Protestants, which we go into a little bit in the book, of the Catholic image of Mary. I mean, there's a sort of misimpression that Catholics adore Mary as a god, which we don't. We view her as the intercessor, as the mother of Jesus, but we pray to her for her intercession for us. We don't adore her as a god. But, you know, those are sort of fine theological points. The painting of, you know, the Catholic Mona Lisa, it's probably worth the price of the entire book, is that panel of the Catholic Mona Lisa by Antonello de Messina. That painting actually was only in the Met for a couple of months. It's in a church in Palermo. And every time I hear someone that went to Palermo, I ask them, did you see the Virgin Annunciation? And they go, where was it? You know, it's not even a museum there. I just think it is the most spectacular painting ever done. And what's so wonderful about it, all these Annunciation paintings, you know, there's always the angel there. And in Antonello's version, there is no angel. There's just, you can see the wind blowing, the angel's appearance blowing the Bible in front of her, right, the scriptures, presumably the Psalms. But the kind of ambiguity of Mary's Annunciation, like, you know, you think about it, when she wakes up the next morning, was that really an angel? What happened there? And the way that she so carefully is following the angel's words, and you could almost see her heart turning from concern to acceptance to her fiat that she is going to take this on. And what I love about the painting is the eyes. It's like you can see in her eyes this determination to take on this task that looks like mission impossible to a young Jewish girl finding herself pregnant in a very conservative Jewish town in the hill country of Judea, and her determination to make it happen, you know. And I asked myself, you know, do I have that kind of determination, you know, because to pursue, you know, to pursue the Christian life requires great perseverance and fortitude. And certainly Mary had that. And we can all pray that she'll intercede for the rest of us where we sometimes fail on that in that respect.
Yeah, and I guess, you know, thinking of Mary, you know, maybe sometimes people have criticized the Christianity in general or the Catholic Church in particular as being sort of, you know, anti-feminine. But, of course, you know, Mary herself, this Mother of God, the Queen of Heaven, really has this enormous feminine motherly role. And similarly, you have a later painting in the book, a French painting of Joan of Arc, you know, another feminine hero. And perhaps there's sort of a parallel that the painting of Joan of Arc shows, sort of depicts Joan of Arc as receiving calling from similarly sort of a sudden calling from angels, you know, calling her in the 15th century in the war against the English to, you know, lead the French, this peasant girl to lead the French in the Hundred Years' War against the English invaders, and then later she'll be burned at the stake. So similar to this Mary painting here, you see a woman who's sort of, you know, called out of the moment to sort of greatness in the midst of daily life.
Yeah, and there's a lot of parallels. They're both poor women, you know, not the kind of person that the intellectuals of the day would have, you know, certainly had a lot of respect for. But they're the ones, the humble-spirited ones that, you know, the angel of the Lord appears to. And, yeah, there are a lot of parallels in that answering the call. And I think it's one of these themes that, you know, comes through in the pilgrimage. And that's why it's not the tour of the Met. It's the pilgrimage to the Met. I mean, it's a spiritual journey, right? And here's another theme that you're pulling out here, which is what about me? You know, have I answered the call? I mean, you know, the Lord is calling all of us at some point. A lot of times we don't even pick up the phone. We assume it's a wrong number. You know, not holy enough, couldn't possibly be me after, you know, and in fact he is. But for different reasons, we don't respond.
Yeah, you know, thinking of common people, another thing that comes out in the book is several occasions you reference how in paintings that the sort of a common person or an ordinary person who commissioned the painting, say, is probably trying to have themselves sort of painted into the painting with these religious themes as sort of a bit character, you might say. Like you have the Duke of Alba commissioned the painter Bernard van Orley, the Spanish Netherlands, to do a painting of the Last Supper, and so you have Jesus with his apostles there, but there are 13 people there, Jesus and the 12 apostles, but then there's also this 14th person whom you notice who's the server there, and you suspect that it's perhaps presumably wealthy person, the Duke of Alba himself, who commissioned the painting, having himself painted in as a server at the Last Supper, and he's the only one in the painting who does not have a halo around him. Aside from Judas, because he's not a saint. And then also in this other painting you discuss with Pontius Pilate washing his hands, there's a soldier there sort of dressed in the armor of a knight of Malta, who are among the individuals who commissioned that painting as well. So a person there is trying to make this argument that, you know, he's among the sinners who, along with Pontius Pilate, has sort of looked away as Jesus is condemned to death. So is that a common aspect of Christian painting, that you often have ordinary people put in the painting?
Yeah, I would actually say it's an aspect of all painting. Like, we often try to put ourselves into the image, right? And it goes all the way back to the tomb of Pernev that we started with. I mean, Pernev's painting himself into the image, but in his case, he's painting himself as bigger than life, as the god. And here in the paintings you just referenced, Andrew, it's the opposite. They painted themselves into the painting as, say, the little person, the humble person, the sinner, and understanding that it's through humility that we can find God. So I think it's a wonderful image. I love the Van Orley, where this very wealthy duke has painted himself in literally as the servant to the apostles. I mean, it's a wonderful, wonderful idea. I think of myself, if I paid all that money for that, it's actually a tapestry. It's not a painting, but it looks like a painting. But, you know, if I'd paid all that money, I probably would have said, well, at least make me like St. Peter or, St. Mark. I mean, give me somebody, a little bigger than the servant than the thing.
Yeah. I guess turning to Jesus himself, I found this depiction of Jesus from Christ carrying the cross from El Greco, as he's called, the Greek one, who is this a painter from Crete originally, but then ended up serving the Holy Roman Empire or the Spanish Habsburg court in Madrid. And so one of his paintings was Christ carrying the cross during his passion. And you noted in the painting that it kind of actually shows kind of an optimistic, sort of hopeful depiction of the crucifixion. It sort of shows like a strong Jesus who's carrying the cross in sort of victory, showing that, with his death, he will overcome death. Whereas, oftentimes in depictions of the crucifixion, you see precisely sort of this mournful image of, the haggard body of Christ who's died on the cross for all the sins of the world. Why did El Greco take this approach to the crucifixion and Jesus's passion?
I think it's because El Greco was a mystic and he was deeply spiritual. We actually devote a whole chapter of the pilgrimage to El Greco because he's an artist that when I was younger, I didn't really fully understand. I only really got to comprehend him much later as my own faith matured. And I realized like he's painting from a perspective of deep faith and understands, like, even today, isn't it the case that most Christians, or many of us, struggle with this idea of the cross, that the path to redemption is through cross, through the suffering. You know, we want the happy part of Christ, but maybe not that part. In fact, if you check the Sotheby's art auctions every year, which I do, you'd find that it's often the case that even the great master paintings, which go for big bucks, sometimes they have to pull any crucifixion paintings they have. It's just not a popular image. But El Greco is trying to paint this image. He paints the cross as like a piece of balsa wood, you know, and pointing out that it's through the cross that we achieve full happiness because we're doing the will of the Father, and that gets us to the place he wants us to get to. You know, another painter many years later, I think, also understood this difficulty of the average viewer struggling with the cross. I'm thinking of Salvador Dali, who appears near the end of the pilgrimage, and he also paints a crucifixion. And Dali was a devout Catholic, actually, had a big conversion experience mid-career, and without getting into Dali too much, but it's this wonderful surrealist image. He was a surrealist modern painter of a crucifixion painting, and he incorporates some of these themes we've been talking about. He paints himself in through the image of his wife as the little person adoring the big person, God, up on the cross. But what's kind of nice about it, I think Dali is trying to explain the cross to a modern audience. He's showing the resurrection and the crucifixion at the same time, right? The resurrection being the happy outcome of this whole experience. And in the surrealist image that he paints, Christ is holding himself to the cross. He's actually not crucified. He's holding himself to it. And he and the cross are already resurrecting and floating up to the heavens. So he's trying, I think he's trying to, in his imagery, emphasize that it's through the cross that we achieve eternity and we find God, you know, and he's kind of emphasizing the happy part of that message. For El Greco, he's showing the happy part in the actual process of carrying the cross, but El Greco's viewers in you know, Spanish, the Habsburg Empire in Spain in the 1600s, late 1500s, would have understood that that was the path to heaven. You know, it was something that was less complicated for them.
Mm-hmm. Well, I guess thinking of one other interesting, looking at these different presentations of faith, and issues concerning faith, you contrast sort of Rembrandt van Rijn, who is in, I guess, Amsterdam, operating in Holland, with, for example, his painting, Aristotle with a bust of Homer, and then with Peter Paul Rubens, who is in Antwerp in the Catholic Netherlands, and who was a Catholic, and Rembrandt was this, you know, Dutch Reformed Protestant, and Rubens had his painting Venus and Adonis, and both of these paintings, you discuss how they deal with this issue of taking the way of the cross, of reaching for virtue and not for the way of the flesh, of, you know, just your desires. What were sort of the differences of this Protestant and this Catholic in their approaches they took to painting and spirituality?
Well, Rubens was a man of the world, and you know, it's just a very different personality than Rembrandt. And he, you know, paints bigger than life images of many nude figures. The Catholics in general were more comfortable, maybe, you know, this is theology of the body 101, but more comfortable with the idea that the body is a creation of God himself. And they're more comfortable with it. Whereas in Protestant Amsterdam, in a very kind of strict, early Calvinist culture there was a real concern about that. But what's really, to me, Rembrandt is the greatest painter of all time. He and there's actually three images by Rembrandt in Pilgrimage where you really see Rembrandt trying to paint the interior life, the life of the soul, the life, in fact, his own soul in struggle. And of course, you know, you're talking about paint on a two-dimensional canvas, and to even think about it, attempting to paint the soul, I mean, most people would find impossible. But Rembrandt does it in such a real way in three of the images that we've got in the book. And the one you're referencing, I think, is Aristotle with a Bust of Homer, where he's painting this image of himself. It actually doesn't look like Rembrandt. People would say, Steve, this is not a portrait of Rembrandt. But, you know, to me, it's a self-portrait. He had a lot of struggles in his life, particularly with, you know, some secret affairs that he was having with his housekeeper and stuff. We go into that in the book. But, you know, he's painting himself here as he was asked to paint a painting of a Greek philosopher. So it's Aristotle, but it's really Rembrandt. And he's struggling with his right hand on virtue, which is the bust of Homer, and his left hand on the ill-gotten wealth of the world, which is this gold chain that Aristotle's famous pupil, Alexander the Great, had sent him. And what's wonderful about the image is cannot tell. I mean, you look at the face of Aristotle, or I would say of Rembrandt, in the painting, and you can see the struggle and the anguish in his face, like, what am I going to do, you know? And he's fingering the gold chain. You can almost see his fingers moving. And then with his right hand, he's patting the head of Homer, of virtue. And what's other thing that's interesting is that the left hand that's holding the gold chain or fingering it is larger than the right hand. So this idea that, you know, the lure of gold, of the riches of the world can draw us. And isn't it the issue that all of us are dealing with today, right? The, you know, do you always pursue the path of virtue or, you know, pursue the gold chain? And I thought Rembrandt really captures that struggle in a very real way for me.
Oh, interesting. That finishes a remark about the hand closing out here. You also talk about how in the Rembrandt's painting of the prodigal son, which you reference in the book, but of course is not at the Met, but is in the museum in St. Petersburg, Russia, that there the hands of the father welcoming the prodigal son, that one hand is larger. The right hand is larger, and that people indicate that that's supposed to reference, you know, the God's mercy and God's judgment. So in that painting, again, you talk about revealing the soul, that sort of autobiographical, that Rembrandt was sort of showing himself, asking for mercy because he had had so many affairs and so forth, and that painting was painted near the end of his life.
Yeah, there's at least three, maybe four, depending on how you count it, of what I call last words of the artist. And, you know, the last thing they paint, and this is Rembrandt's last painting. What's interesting about it is some people consider it his greatest painting. It's at the Hermitage, as you mentioned, and there's been whole books written about the return of the prodigal son. Many people are familiar with that image. They may not realize it's Rembrandt that painted it. But, you know, it's really kind of interesting to think about what would be my last painting. And in this case, there's no commission. He paints it for his own purposes, and it's his last word, really. You know, he's returning. In his youth as a painter, he led the good life. There's self-portraits of him having a pretty good time. He, you know, partied, maybe frittered away some of his talent, and here he is near the end, returning in the image of the prodigal son, you know, tattered clothing and worn out sandals, and hoping for that loving embrace from the father that he gets, that all of us hope for. I think Rembrandt finds God through that humility near the end.
All right. right. Well, excellent. Well, for our listeners out there, we've been listening to another episode of Conservative Casual Friday with your show host, Andrew Herod. And we've been discussing this excellent new book by Wall Street investor and Catholic evangelist Stephen Auth, Pilgrimage to the Museum, Man's Search for God Through Art and Time by Sophia Institute Press. Well, Stephen, thank you for joining the show.
Thank you, Andrew. Really a pleasure speaking with you. And thank you for reading Pilgrimage to the Museum.
All right. Well, for our listeners out there, join us next Friday for another episode of Conservative Casual Friday.